Recording live at Studio 710 in beautiful downtown Vancouver, you're listening to License to Chill with your host, Bert Hick of Rising Tide Consultants. In studio today, Bert sits down with former Surrey City Councillor Berinda Rasoday, the CEO and co-founder of GrowTech Labs. In 2017, she founded the National Institute for Cannabis Health and Education, and a year later, CannabisWise, an accreditation program aimed to help Canadian consumers identify products that are created with quality control, legality, and responsible cannabis use in mind. Along with co-founder Natasha Ray, she launched She Talks in 2015, an open speaker series for women which connects and inspires them through the stories they share. Berinda has been recognized as one of Vancouver's 50 most powerful people by Vancouver Magazine and is widely regarded as one of the most influential women in the cannabis industry today. We go now to Bert in conversation.
Good afternoon. My name is Bert Hick of Rising Tide Consultants. Welcome to our podcast. Berinda years ago started to get involved with cannabis. Berinda, how did that happen? Did you just wake up one day and just decided, I'm going to get into cannabis and to the business? Or how did that transition happen?
No, actually, while I was a municipal councillor and chair of the police committee in the city of Surrey, I only had the filter of public safety and public health. And I was also on the board of Fraser Health. So my eyes opened around cannabis after a friend of mine's mom was dying of cancer. And I watched how she was able to medicate with cannabis versus opioids and how she was still able to engage with her family in her last few weeks. But what I found more fascinating was how her dad, who wasn't responding well to any anti-anxiety meds, was able to use cannabis to alleviate his anxiety. So then I started to do some research. And as you know, policy is a big passion of mine. And I noticed a big void in the cannabis space around education and was quite concerned that unless there was a body established to provide and create a bridge between the cannabis industry and the mainstream business professional and health organizations, that the road to normalization would be much longer. And I think by looking at what's going on today, a year later, I think that sadly proved to be true.
Absolutely. And so that led you to Niche?
Yes. So we founded a nonprofit called the National Institute for Cannabis Health and Education. The focus is very clear. It's to educate Canadians on legalization. And really, its purpose wasn't to be an organization that was at that point communicating directly with consumers. It was more around engaging with boards of trade, health associations, business associations. Because at that point, not a lot of these associations had even started to talk about what the regulations meant for their businesses or their mandates. Now we have shifted over Niche. Jenna Valeria, who's PhD, very well regarded, is now in charge of Niche. And now we're doing more cross-cultural education and one-on-one director education of people versus organizations, but the organization piece is still on the table.
Okay, and Niche communicates out through their website as well as they still produce a publication?
Yeah, Niche participates in a number of ways on education. We do have a very significant social media presence, but we also have written a number of policy papers that have gone out to decision makers. For example, in the last provincial municipal election, we produced a guide for municipal candidates to understand cannabis and what legalization meant. We also have a publication called Botanique Magazine that was sent to elected officials across the country and major health associations. And so what we did is we communicated to people about cannabis in a way that was comfortable to them. There are many great ways and publications and companies who do excellent work, but they, at that point, were very targeted to the cannabis community already. And so we wanted to produce something that you could leave on your coffee table and not feel like you had to hide if your mother-in-law came over. And even though that's a bit of a sad statement, that is still a mentality. Even when I took on the role with Niche, my adult children were really proud of what I was doing, but it took me 3 months to tell my parents. And I don't think we've moved far enough off that as we should have a year in. So there's still lots of work to do.
Yeah, I agree with you. I love the publication. When I first read it, I thought, my gosh, this is classy. It's well-researched. Articles were interesting and very informative. So I highly recommend anyone to pick up a copy of it and get it, because I just think it really raises the communication around the whole issue of cannabis and raises awareness. So after that, you got into GrowTech Labs.
Yes. Yeah, so there is a step in between there. While I was traveling around the country, talking to people who were not understanding cannabis or who were actually naysayers, and trying to communicate with them in a fashion that didn't make them feel either vulnerable or attacked, one of the things that we learned very quickly is that Canadian consumers, especially new consumers, kept raising the issue of quality. You know, we in Canada aren't the same buffet-style culture as the U.S., so the movements around non-GMO, organic, farm-to-table have done exceptionally well here in Canada, and so has VQA for the wine industry, and quality assurance programs, whether it's electronics or business practices, are entrenched in the Canadian culture. So we produced a quality assurance program called CannabisWise. Adolfo Gonzalez helped us write out some standards at that point. Very quickly, once we launched the program, we got approached by a larger organization called Cannabis Quality Assurance. And we're just in the process now of amalgamating CannabisWise with Cannabis Quality Assurance. And what was also very evident and saddened me actually quite a bit was watching how BC is losing its lead as the world leader on cannabis. BC Bud is world renowned. We have not only the best growers and processors, but are the activists who actually brought this to the forefront and fought the fight for so long to have legalization at the table, weren't being recognized in the same way, because now a lot of the licensed producers are based out of Ontario and Alberta. And those governments seem to embrace the cannabis legalization policy quicker than we did here in BC. So we founded GrowTech Labs, which is an accelerator with a focus on keeping BC at the forefront. We started off as a traditional accelerator, looking at companies who would develop tech to advance the cannabis industry in BC. But what we found was actually something that now has proven to be something that will create a real legacy. And that is, we're taking pre-legalization processors, producers, and products and helping them get regulated. There is no better quality, whether it's for edibles, oils, or quality cannabis, like there is in the pre-legalization industry. And we fear that the $7.1 billion documented by the Fraser Institute boost to our economy is going to be lost if those people aren't given a clear path to get into the regulated market.
So one step led to another.
Always.
It's like crossing a river on stepping stones. Now, I want to come back to cannabis quality assurance.
Yeah.
I can relate to that because prior to getting involved with cannabis, I was involved and still am involved with liquor licensing. Mm-hmm. And we have a program called VQA for the wine industry. And if you go into any government liquor store, you see the VQA products right at the front aisle, by the front door, very prominently displayed, and product that has been certified as being quality assured by a vintner. So the cannabis quality assurance program is similar to that. And I was shocked to read someone did an analysis of some of the products that they picked up off the shelf of a government cannabis store, had it independently tested, and some of it came back for pesticides. There was the THC levels were wrong and that sort of stuff. So the whole thing about cannabis quality assurance is to make sure that the customer, when they buy the product, knows exactly what they're getting. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And I think in order to normalize cannabis for those people who are reluctantly now trying cannabis, whether it's for recreational purposes or they're wanting to use topicals for the achy knee, we know that the group that's the highest adopters of legalization have been seniors. One of the things that's really important is that cannabis is a plant, but it's very complex. The growing methods definitely have impact on the quality of the product. And so Canadians look for a high quality product and are willing to pay more. And sadly, we have read a lot of scenarios of where people who are sophisticated cannabis consumers are not finding the quality that they need or expect or rightfully demand from licensed producers. So we do think that it's very important to put something in play that sets targets and tells consumers very quickly which products have been certified higher quality.
I think it's an amazing initiative. I think it's really needed because there's so many people who want to experiment with this and they want to go where it's safe, mm-hmm. where they feel it's been tested and protected. Mm-hmm. So coming back to GrowTech Labs, I find this fascinating. So basically the concept of GrowTech Labs is you will arrange to have a greenhouse facility, a location where people can come in, rent a space, grow their own cannabis, and kind of an incubation center.
Well, that's one of the things we're doing. We first started by funding a tech company called Elevated Signals that's built software to help growers monitor and set metrics for water, light, all of the things that make a plant grow. And then after that, we're working with a couple of pre-legalization brands to get them into the regulated market. But we've also established, in partnership with the BC Co-op Association, a co-op, a fairly large co-op here in BC. And again, it's to keep the small, medium producers and processors at the forefront of the international scene with the best bud in the world. And what came out of that process was we did 6 regional meetings to consult with growers. Then we did 6 regional meetings around the governance. We're just in the process of developing the bylaws and the regulations. And this is going to be wholly owned by the growers who run the co-op. We provided the startup dollars, not with any intention of getting any revenue benefits from the co-op outside of us being a member of the co-op as a founding partner. But it's really important to maintain the legacy of BC Cannabis and to give people who will not have an opportunity to stay in the regulated market because it is so hard and expensive to get licensed. I mean, that can be demonstrated by the sheer lack of numbers on how many micro growers have actually received their license in the province of BC. Again, through that process, because for us, it's always about learning from the community versus telling the community what's good for them, is we found that there were growers who were very interested in the collective model but didn't want to be a part of a co-op per se. So now we're in the process of establishing 3 canaparks, which will be sites where microgrowers can come within a facility that is a collective but have their own area to grow. Health Canada is very happy with this model. And so we're in the process of securing land in municipalities that are okay and have zoning bylaws that allow cannabis. And that model will launch in January of this year.
Okay. So again, so the process would be that they would grow their product in your facility and then they would sell it to the cannabis distribution branch.
Yeah. So everything has to, there's not a lot of room to do things very differently. It's all very strictly mandated by regulations. So at this point, microcultivators are allowed to grow 2,100 square feet. It has to be in a contained unit separate from other growers. We are looking at modulars, C-cans, for growers on ALR property. But again, we've also lobbied the federal government. If you go to our site, you'll find an economic impact paper that we did to show government that really they should be increasing the canopy size to 4,200 square feet and alleviating some of the burdens around the regulatory process because of the economic benefit to the province, if that's done. Because we really believe that these growers, to have a chance to continue to be in the market, not only need to have a facility which is licensed within a reasonable amount of dollars. Right now it takes about $1 million, which is really a huge barrier. But the other thing that we've lobbied the provincial government for, and we have had a couple of meetings with Minister Farnworth and with the Premier, is to have a very similar concept to craft beer, where with craft beer, you have a separate distribution model, you have a separate retail model, and you're able to have consumption sites that add to tourism for the province. And, you know, I feel quite confident that this government is open to that concept because they do understand the value of the craft industry. They do understand the value of the tourism we could attach to that. But having that separate distribution and retail model, I think would be an ideal situation to put BC in a very unique position to the rest of the country.
And that gets us back to what you said earlier about getting BC back at the center plate, if you will, for growing cannabis and being to retail, growing cannabis to what NASA is to space.
Absolutely.
Being the experts.
Absolutely. And we shouldn't lose that. I mean, it's not lost on us in the learning that I've done about the people who, you know, lots of parallels to what's going on in the world today in the Nixon era when people were fleeing the Vietnam War and were coming to Canada and they were undocumented workers. And, you know, families provided through almost like communes, you know, an opportunity for people to not only prosper, but make a huge contribution to medicinal patients and to recreational patients. And you can't beat the experience of the number of years and the generational knowledge and the genetics that have been passed through. And, you know, if we could do it all again, I wonder how many people in government would think that they should have fast-tracked the pre-legalization industry first and then open the door to the licensed producer model, because unfortunately it's not showing a lot of success. And I think the damage being done by large producers who aren't producing good quality cannabis and who are taking shortcuts on the regulations really damaged the industry. And it's also damaged not only the reputation of the Canadian industry, but, you know, families who've invested through the stock market. A lot of are feeling a lot of pain right now.
Yeah. Well, it's my observations that a lot of the people who are involved in the black market, gray market, producers, retailers were shunned from being involved in any discussions around the licensing process they should have and how they should put this into place. And government came in with their own regulations, their own processes, and I think it's worked to our disadvantage here.
Absolutely. And, you know, some people will come to me and say, how can you be such an advocate for people who are breaking the law? And I said, I come from the other side of the table. We as elected officials in this province enabled the pre-legalization market to exist. It was not lost on anybody, the communities that thrived because of pre-legalization, cannabis producers and processors. Everybody knew it was going on. So we can't penalize those people for being successful and making such a huge contribution to communities where families were living well, by saying now we're going to shut you out because we've decided that other people should have an opportunity, even though the only reason this opportunity is on the table is because of you.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. And it goes back to me to the days of prohibition on liquor, where the people who were involved in the illegal sale of liquor during prohibition were allowed to participate once prohibition ended. So the Seagram's family and other people stayed in. They were able to participate in it and take that expertise and knowledge and have it incorporated into what existed. So with GrowTech Labs, You're looking at one facility or multiple facilities?
We're looking at multiple facilities, but we're also looking at encouraging people who have produced quality brands, products, for a long period of time. We don't want people to feel discouraged and feel like they have no space in the regulated market. And that may be because the fees that are attached to getting regulated, or some of the overburden on the security requirements and other things. We want all those, mostly families actually, who are producing great products to still have a shot in the regulated market. So we've created a business model to help make that happen.
Do you see any movement in regulatory jurisdiction between the federal government and the provinces in this area, or we're going to probably stay as we are right now?
You know, it really shocks me when I speak and ask people a show of hands to how many people have ever contacted an elected official at any level of government, and how few. Sometimes it's only one or two hands in rooms full of hundreds of people, actually. We have a federal election coming up, and I think it's an opportunity to motivate all parties to look at change. I hope the change definitely happens on deregulating CBD as a controlled substance like the U.S. has done. I think it's an opportunity to look at some of the unintended consequences and damage that the regulatory process has done, not only at the production level, but also at the retail level. I think there's going to be great change. I think what we see this year, each year will look very different. And 5 years from now, I think cannabis legalization will finally be what it should be, and normalization will be at a point where we've eliminated all the stereotypes and myths, and people are no longer shy about consuming cannabis. But I think we're at a very pivotal point in the next few months, and encourage all listeners, as you do, Bert, also to engage in the political process, because this is where we can motivate some really big change.
Yeah, and that gets back to where we started this podcast, back to niche and educating people and awareness, because a lot of people who are involved in the regulation of it don't know anything really about the details of the program and the product itself. I find it amazing that this one plant has so many properties that are so beneficial to so many people, whether it be health or wellness and all that, and the other topics. Now, I understand with the ICBC conference coming up in Vancouver in September, you're going to be chairing a panel.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to chairing the panel on the craft industry. And, we're fortunate enough to have people like Jamie Shaw and Ryan Lee and Dr. Jenna Valeria on our advisory board at GrowTech. But definitely, I think an opportunity to have conversation and to get the attention of decision makers at the provincial level. I do think people do pay attention to the conferences that happen and the messaging that comes up. And I think the timing is great as well, because it's right around UBCM. And for those people who don't know, it's the Union of BC Municipalities, where all mayors and councillors from across the province and their senior staff and provincial government gather to debate and dialogue on these issues. Niche Canada, for the third year in a row, has been declined to present an educational workshop at UBCM, which really boggles my brain, because it's really high-level education that's needed. So I think it's very timely that the ICBC conference is taking place in September, and I think it's the craft cannabis panel is going to be a good opportunity to talk about these issues in a more public way.
I just want to add to that comment. Last year, I drove to Whistler to the UBCM conference to get up there, because there's supposed to be a panel discussion on cannabis. I want to be there. We paid for the hotel room, drove up, registered for the conference, got there, and found out the cannabis session had been canceled. And I was shocked to hear that this year, as we're approaching the anniversary of cannabis, that there's no discussion on cannabis whatsoever. And I find it bizarre, because every municipality is rolling out cannabis in a different way. And some of the provincial regulations and policies are completely contrary to what's allowed at the municipal level. And We're dealing with one right now, for example, in the city of North Vancouver, where the provincial regulations does not allow of line of sight from the street into a cannabis store. So you have to have an opaque window, similar to a Red Hot video store, an adult store, and no sight line into the store. But yet on Lonsdale in the city of North Vancouver, they have a policy at the city level that they want to have clear visibility into the retail store area, which is causing a problem. And so the cannabis store operators on that have been approved by the city are having a challenge on that street. The other one we find is municipalities are saying, we won't issue a business license for a retail cannabis store until you have provincial government approval for a approval. But the other side is they won't issue a business license, so you got the other side. So you got this battle between a business license versus a retail cannabis site. Which comes first? Somebody has to blink. And I thought there'd be some discussion at UBCM around these sort of issues and trying to harmonize some of the policies between municipalities. So it's kind of an even playing field in terms of what the regulations are, the distancing requirements, and have some discussion as we're coming up on the 1 year anniversary. And I was also hoping that it would be an opportunity for those municipalities who are still watching, waiting to see what happens, to make a decision if they're going to go forward with it. We look at retail cannabis stores, with municipalities regarding retail cannabis stores as being either red light, green light, or yellow light. So there are those green light municipalities like Vancouver, District North Vancouver, North Vancouver, but we also have some yellow light ones like Coquitlam and who are waiting and seeing, and then we got the red light ones like Richmond and Surrey who are saying no. And I think it'd be beneficial for those municipalities to be part of the debate to see how things are rolling out and if they're going to roll out cannabis, how they should do it.
Absolutely. And to add to all of those really important things that you've highlighted, it's the whole conversation around the opioid crisis, you know, harm reduction and how cannabis plays a role in that. It's the whole conversation, you know, the United Nations recognizes over 3 million people a year die from ailments attached to alcohol. 25 million people have been negatively impacted by the opioid crisis around the world. So it's not only the regulatory conversations that the decision makers at UBCM should be having, like the ridiculous concept of not being able to look into a retail store. Let me tell you, I wouldn't work in a store or allow any of my children to work in a store where you're actually creating a hazard by having somebody be able to you know, rob the store without anybody on the street seeing. There's so many of these regulations that don't make sense. But I also compel people at UBCM and the decision makers to have a higher level conversation about harm reduction and how cannabis is a part of that. And nobody's willing to talk about that in an organized, structured fashion yet.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. People like to know what they're walking into. Yeah. People like to know what they're walking out of. Yeah. And I just find that this current approach reminds me of the old days of the liquor stores. You're too young to remember this.
Well, maybe not.
But where there was no sight lines from the street into a liquor store or even at that time into a bar or pub. We had the old days where at a hotel pub, men went in one door, women and escorts went in another door, leading to the same room, but it was all brick walls, solid, no sight lines. You couldn't see somebody drinking. Now, eventually, and it happened in the 80s, that liquor stores had windows. They had chandeliers, music. And you could see into a liquor store, a government liquor store. And the bars and pubs, well, it's easy to walk down the street now and you see somebody sitting on a patio. I just walked past folks at the Cactus restaurant here on Burrard Street having a glass of wine and beers on a Friday afternoon. Great. So I hopefully we'll get to that point with cannabis where there is a sight line in the store for personal safety and security because the current policy just makes it look totally uninviting.
It not only makes it uninviting, I just want somebody to justify sort of the impact, negative impact that we're having on a potentially industry that will contribute millions to our economy, billions actually to our economy. And I think all of that's being lost. I think the one province who attempted to do a good job has been the province of New Brunswick, where they actually moved this file out of their health and Solicitor General's file into the economic development file. And I'm really hoping that government can be educated to the point where they actually understand the value, not only in economic impacts, but to people's wellness, but also to the fact that if you look at the U.S. states that have legalized, crime is reduced. The number of disturbances caused by drinking is reduced. So there are some very clear metrics that show the value to communities of having retail cannabis available to consumers. And, you know, you mentioned Surrey, and that's a great example of the amount of crime and the amount of small junior gang warfare that takes place among these dialer dopers. Well, it just makes sense to me to put them out of business. But they've done the opposite, which is to ban all cannabis retail in the second largest city in the province. And they have now created a very fruitful future for those dialer dopers who cause so much chaos in the community.
Yeah. I've often felt by making something illegal causes people to crave that.
Yeah.
I sometimes have often thought that we should make strawberry ice cream illegal because it makes everybody crave for strawberry ice cream and legalize everything else so that they would go after strawberry ice cream and want that, and that would become the illegal market. It's also good for the strawberry growers. But by making something illegal, it makes a problem. They should, and to me, Surrey should get on the bandwagon and figure out how they roll out a program to have responsible operators selling it within their community. And I hope they do get to yes.
I hope they do get to yes, too. And I think access is another issue that will be brought up because in the greater Vancouver Regional District, having to drive from one city to another is quite a chore, especially on depending on what time of day you're doing it. And Surrey itself is as large as geographically Richmond, Burnaby, and Vancouver combined. So not to provide access to people in Surrey where they would have to drive at least an hour out, I think is something that may be up for a challenge at some point because it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Now, I want to switch gears a little bit. I want to talk about Sheet Talks.
Yeah.
I always found that one fascinating when I first heard that you're involved with Sheet Talks. Talk about that. Talk about Sheet Talks.
So in 2014, I ran for mayor in the city of Surrey, knowing what a difficult task that would be. But it proved to be even more difficult than my mostly female-led team had thought. There was a group of women who were talking about doing a speaker series at the same time I was running for office. And then after the election, we held our first event called She Talks. CNN picked us as one of the top 10 things to do in the world for International Women's Day in 2015. And the premise is that women our entire lives are told, look better, be better, do better. And we say, no, you're fine just the way you are. And when women hear other women's authentic stories, they look at the women on the stage and the one thing that happens for sure is they're like, oh, she's just like me. She's either dealt with depression, illness, divorce, you know, caring for senior parents, challenges in the workplace. And really the purpose is to have 16 women get up on stage, share their real, raw, authentic story to motivate other women, for women to know they're fine just the way they are. And it also has created a great network. We've had over 184 women speak. I had a radio show while Roundhouse was open. We did a weekly show. And it was just really about being vulnerable and being authentic and knowing that you don't have to be perfect to succeed. And those parameters that are placed on women by others on what life should look like need to be shattered. And if we just keep on our own path, things work out quite well.
So what are the next steps for She Talks?
So She Talks, we do an annual event in March. So the next event will be next year, International Women's Day. Women can nominate themselves or others on from our website called shetalks.life and participate by either sharing their story or be in a room to hear some amazing stories.
So where do you hold this, at the convention center?
No, we rotate between south and north of the Fraser. Last year's event took place at Elements Casino in Surrey. Next year's event, we're looking for a venue here in Vancouver. And, you know, we were really happy to have a number of cannabis speakers at the last two events. And it really not only empowers women, but educates women. And I think we will continue to use it also as a way of normalizing cannabis use, because when you hear of women who talk about cannabis use, a lot of women in the room are shocked because, again, people still have those myths and stereotypes in their mind about what a cannabis consumer looks like. Nobody thinks they look like me. But it's a really interesting way, as we're building a movement, to say women are fine just the way they are, but the choices women make and why when they share them certainly motivates other women as well.
So the dates are March of next year.
Yeah.
And people can buy tickets to go to it?
Yes. People can go to our website and buy tickets closer to the event.
And the website is?
Shetalks.life.
Shetalks.life. All right. Brenda, you amaze me.
Oh, well, thank you.
I got to tell you, I've known you for years.
Yeah.
And somebody once said about Benjamin Franklin that he lives outside of his own skin. You're like the Energizer Bunny on a car battery. You are so busy, so active, so involved with community affairs, GrowTech Labs, cannabis quality assurance, niche, She Talks, everything else. You've got a big heart, and you just amaze me. So thank you very much for being our first guest on our podcast, and wish you all the best, and I hope you'll come back sometime. We're going to do another session, hopefully close to October the 17th. I'd love to have you come back and talk about the high points and the low points of legalization of cannabis. And by then, we're going to have this event happen in Canada called an election.
Oh, yes, yes. And before the election, we at GrowTech Labs are doing two events. One is a roundtable on the discussion of CBD, because we do want to attract some attention to that issue during the federal election. And the other is a roundtable on the packaging requirements that have been placed on producers and processors, which are ridiculous. So I look forward to that. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to be on your podcast, Licensed to Chill. I think it's really important that we have dialogue. And I think it's really important that we have dialogue that bridges the pre and post cannabis industry, but also regular business and governmental conversations with the cannabis industry. Because I think, you know, having what I call cross-pollination is really important step in moving forward to normalizing cannabis. And so thank you for your contribution.
Well, you're welcome. But before you run away, you just gave us two pearls about two events through GrowTech Lab coming up. How's that going to roll out? How do people hear about this? Where do they go? Where do they participate?
So if you go to our website, growtechlabs.com, we'll have the event dates and information posted there. We charge very nominal fee just to barely cover the cost of the event. But we will be producing two policy papers from those events that we will be forwarding to all three levels of government as well.
Great. Thank you very much,
Brenda. Thank you.
The preceding podcast was recorded at Studio 710 in downtown Vancouver, the home of Jade Maple. For more information, follow us online at risingtideconsultants.ca.